Whilst we are in the male circumcision, cutting edge of HIV prevention. My name is David Sorada from Makerere University in Uganda, and my co-chair is Brian Morris from Sydney University. I must admit we have a late breaker inserted into this program, so we are going to be a little bit tight on time, and we shall be a little bit brutal on timing and taking questions very quickly. So we will. So there's going to be a little bit of change in the program, as I will illustrate. So the first presenter is Dr. Godfrey Chigozie from the Rakai Health Science Program. He's going to present on safety of adult male circumcision in HIV infection and uninfected men in Rakai. Dr. Chigozie is a graduate of Makerere University and did his master's in public health in Johns Hopkins University. Godfrey, please.
Thank you very much, Chairman. My presentation this morning is on... I can't see anything on my screen. The safety of adult male circumcision in HIV-infected and uninfected men in Rakai, Uganda. Okay. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge my co-investigators from Johns Hopkins University, Makerere University, and the Uganda Virus Research Institute. I'd like to acknowledge trial participants, our funders, that's the Gates Foundation, as well as the U.S. National Institute of Health, and the whole of the Rakai program staff. The objective of the analysis that we did was assess the safety of adult male circumcision by comparing rates of adverse events related to circumcision among HIV-positive and HIV-negative men. As many of us already know, three randomized controlled trials have shown that male circumcision reduces the risk of HIV acquisition in men by between 50 and 60%. And we already know that WHO has recommended male circumcision as an additional strategy for preventing heterosexual HIV infection in men. The safety of surgery is therefore a paramount consideration in planning future circumcision programs in order to minimize surgical risks and to provide guidelines for best practices in surgical procedures and postoperative care. Some information is available on postoperative complications in children and HIV-negative men, with complication rates ranging from 2 to 10% if the circumcision is done by trained medical persons under aseptic conditions. However, we have little information on the safety of male circumcision in HIV-infected individuals. If surgery is actually unsafe in HIV-negative men, then we would have to exclude HIV-negative men from programs which would potentially stigmatize them, or we would have to require to have specialized services for postoperative care, which could add to program costs and complexity. We conducted two separate but complementary randomized controlled trials of adult male circumcision in Rakai. One trial, which was supported by the National Institute of Health, was stopped in December 2006 for efficacy, and the other trial, which was supported by the Gates Foundation and enrolled HIV-positive men, enrollment was stopped by the DSMB in December again because of futility. In these two trials, we enrolled 2,326 HIV-negative men and 420 HIV-positive men I take that back. We circumcised actually 2,326 HIV negative men and 520 HIV positive men. And this surgery was done by trained physicians using the sleeve circumcision procedure. All men who are circumcised provided written informed consent, and we are strongly advised to refrain from sexual intercourse until the wound was certified healed by our clinicians. Men, we are advised to practice safe sex, and that's the ABC. And we did postoperative follow-up at approximately 1 day, 7 days, and 1 month post-surgery. And during these follow-up visits, we assessed surgery-related adverse events. We looked at wound healing and resumption of intercourse. Adverse events we agreed as mild, moderate, or severe. Moderate and severe adverse events actually required medical care or surgical intervention. All adverse events were reviewed and summarized by a medical officer at the time they were reported. We used chi-square or Fisher's exact tests to compare adverse event rates and wound healing between HIV-positive and HIV-negative men. We used metabolic regression to assess factors associated with surgery-related adverse events. What did we find? Now, for those of you who are interested in numbers, you can look at the upper part. Those who hate numbers can look at the bottom section. We compared the characteristics of HIV-positive and HIV-negative men at enrollment, and looking at marital status and education, we found HIV-positive men were more likely to be married, looking at that number, that one, and less educated, comparing that. As regards sex, number of sex partners reported in the past year, again, HIV-positive men reported more sexual partners compared to HIV-negative men. Among sexually active, the sexually active population, HIV-positive men again reported less consistent condom use, 7.5 compared to 16.5, and had higher rates of STD symptoms, including GOD, urethral discharge, and dysuria. We looked at surgery-related adverse events by severity, and overall, we found no significant difference in rates of moderate or severe surgery-related adverse events between HIV-positive and HIV-negative men. The rates of grade 2 and grade 3 adverse events were 3.1 compared to 3.6. Pointing to grade 2 and grade 3 adverse events because they are the ones that required medical or surgical intervention. We looked at common surgery-related adverse events by severity, and the commonest adverse events we found was infection, and the rate of moderate or severe infections were 1.9 in HIV positives, about 2.3 among the HIV negatives. It's different, and the rest were not significantly different. Looking at bleeding and hematoma, again, we found no significant difference in complication rates. Bleeding and hematoma have that rate in HIV positives and that in HIV negatives. The rates of the wound healing were a bit higher among HIV positives compared to HIV negatives. But again, the rate was not statistically significant, the difference. Now, we looked at surgery-related events again by timing of resumption of sexual intercourse among the two groups. And what we see is that adverse events rates are generally higher in men who resume sex before wound healing compared to those who resume sex after wound healing was satisfied. However, the differences are not statistically significant, and this is true for both groups, HIV-positive and HIV-negative men. We also looked at rate of complete wound healing, and what we are seeing is that the proportion of men with complete wound healing, at least by 30 days post-surgery, was lower in HIV-positive men compared to HIV-negative men. And multiple LG6 regression identified no significant demographic behaviors or STS symptoms that were predictive of moderate or severe adverse events. In conclusion, overall, the safety of circumcision was comparable in both HIV-positive and HIV-negative men. We find the rates of moderate or severe adverse events accepted by the law in both HIV-positive and HIV-negative men, and wound healing was somewhat slower among the HIV-infected men. Resumption of sex before wound healing was associated with higher complication rates, though these higher rates were not statistically significant. Thank you very much.
All right. I take it there are no questions.
To the microphone, if you would, please.
I have a question.
Oh, yes, right.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Kevin, yes.
WHO. Were you able to stratify your incidence of adverse events in the infected men by CD4 status?
We have not done that by CD4 status, but we can have a look at that.
Do you have any idea of the CD4 distribution of the HIV-infected men?
Well, the men that we actually enrolled had CD4s greater than 350. Men who had CD4s below 350 were excluded. At the beginning of the trial, we were including men who had diabetes of stage 1 and 2, irrespective of their CD4 counts.
But that seems very important, that if immunosuppressed men were excluded, then I don't think you can really conclude that you can't say generalize that adverse events are the same across HIV-infected and uninfected.
Yeah, actually, these findings, I think it's in one of the slides, is they are true for men who have CD4s greater than 350, as well as HIV-positive men, WHO stage 1 and 2.
Kevin, that's a good point, and I think we could, in an analysis, try to do further stratification onto that. Any other question? All right. I think we better move on. We have to move on to the next presentation, and this was a late breaker presentation in Saturday. This is male postcoital penile cleansing and the risk of HIV acquisition in uncircumcised men in Rakai District. It's going to be presented by Dr. Fred Macombe. Dr. Fred Macombe has a PhD in biostatistics from Johns Hopkins University and works with Rakai Health Science Program.
Thank you very much for the introduction. On behalf of my co-authors, I'm presenting male postcoital penile cleansing and the risk of HIV acquisition in uncircumcised men in Rakai District. We know that the HIV epidemic remains unabated, especially in Southern Africa. HIV prevention interventions include male circumcision and the APC strategy, which is well known. The three RCTs have demonstrated the male circumcision efficacy, and this has now been recommended by the WHO. However, there are substantial challenges to male circumcision scale-up, including safety, ethical, social, culture, and realize that many national governments, especially in Southern Africa, have not yet fully endorsed this strategy. However, there are other additional prevention methods to be explored, which includes penile microbicide wipe, postcoital cleansing with water and soap, both of those which may potentially reduce or eliminate infectious vaginal secretions. Use of water and or water with or without soap following coitus is quite common in Africa. However, there are no prospective studies conducted to assess the impact of HIV acquisition in uncircumcised men practicing the postcoital hygiene. Use of water and soap for STI prophylaxis showed some reduction in GUDs, publications shown above. Also, a study conducted in Kenya showed that bathing after sex was associated with reduced odds of being HIV positive, but this population was highly circumcised men. We know, again from research in Kenya, vaginal cleansing using water or soap was associated with increased HIV acquisition among females. Therefore, we set out to assess the association between the postcoital penile cleansing and the risk of HIV acquisition among uncircumcised men. The trial in Rakai enrolled about 2,500 uncircumcised men in the control arm, aged 15 to 49, HIV negative, who accepted VCT, with the follow-ups at 6, 12, and 24 months. Among the data collected was the genital hygiene information. All of us know the trial was unblinded on December 12th after showing efficacy of 51% in the interim analysis. We specifically looked at the questions, data obtained from questions on genital hygiene practices after intercourse, which included questions on whether people reported penile cleansing after sexual intercourse and the cleansing materials used, as shown. We also asked men questions on duration of time from completion of coital cleansing, and this time was self-reported in minutes for each sexual partner they had sex with. Here are some key definitions for the analysis. We have the washed with all partners. If a man reported cleansing the penis following coitus with all sexual partners, he was put in that category. Washed with some, if they cleansed with their penis with some, but not all sexual partners. And there are some who say they never washed or they reported no cleansing with any sexual partner. The self-reported duration from coitus to cleansing was categorized in those three groups as shown. All this information obtained from the control arm of the trial at those subsequent follow-up visits, and the behaviors were assessed for the periods preceding the interview of those specific follow-up visits. We have a total of about 4,300 intervals with the data on postcoital cleansing, which were accrued from sexually active men. And we have about 83% of those follow-up intervals where men reported washing with all sexual partners they had sex with. We have about 2,300 intervals with the data available on cleansing materials used. For the analysis, we estimated the HIV incident rate by per 100 person years, and we have the incident rate ratios using the Pasteur regression model. And we had covariates, fixed covariates, which were age and marital status, which were obtained at the time of enrollment. And we also had time-varying covariates, mainly sexual risk behaviors, known to be associated with HIV infection, as shown on the slide. For the covariates in the adjusted analysis, all those variables included had to have a p-value of 0.15 in the inverted analysis, or those risk ratios, 2 and above, or less than 0.5, all suspected confounders, and use stata for the analysis. What do we find? This table shows postcoital washing with partners, the never washed, washed, and washed with all. What we see at the end of the day, we realize that men who's reported in the intervals consistent washing, we see that it was not associated with a reduction in HIV. The incident risk ratio was about 1.5, but that was not significant, as we see the wide confidence intervals. And all the analysis was adjusted for condom use, marital status, age, frequency of sex, perceived partner's HIV risk. Table number 2 shows duration from sex to penile washing. Many asked whether they washed. We did not ask them what materials they used, whether they used soap or not, but the question was, did you wash? So, and the time periods were categorized as shown. And what we see is that increasing trend that HIV incidence was significantly lower if washing was delayed 10 minutes or above. We see sort of an increasing, a decreasing trend in the incidence as the increasing time, the duration from from intercourse to washing. Then we also looked at the methods used for cleansing, and reported cloth alone. Some used cloth and washing, and there are those who reported washing alone. And we see increasing degree of wetness as assessed by self-reported washing being associated with a borderline significant trend of increasing risk of HIV acquisition. In summary, we see that in this population or group, this cohort, this group of uncircumcised men, the control arm of the trial, postopenile cleansing is common in this population. But as practiced in that group of men, it did not offer protection from HIV acquisition. And these were uncircumcised men, again, I emphasize. Washing less than 10 minutes, as shown again, after intercourse, may increase HIV risk from this data relative to those who delayed cleansing. Washing alone, again, is associated with a non-significant increase in HIV acquisition among uncircumcised men. I must admit these results were sort of troubling and not expected. And like I was saying, some people may think that, oh, should we stop washing or hygiene? But the results did speak for themselves, that we need to understand them. What are they saying? What are they meaning? However, those are some of the possible explanations that we postulate that the acidic pH of vaginal secretions may impair HIV survival. Therefore, use of water with a neutral pH may facilitate viral survival and possible infectivity. Therefore, the delayed cleansing may reduce the viral infectivity by prolonged exposure to the acidic vaginal secretions, as we saw that duration and HIV incidence. However, there are some limitations in this study or this analysis. These are observational data in the uncircumcised control arm of the trial. They are self-reported data as well, but really have no reason to believe that they are unreliable. It's important that I realize that we never collected information on use of soap, which may potentially irritate the subperiosal mucosa. However, in this cohort of Rakai, where some of these men were selected to come into the trial, 75% of the men in the cohort who washed say that they used water, rather they used soap as one of the substances, although we never picked that specific information during the trial. We realized also that we did not, again, pick any detailed information on how the actual practice of cleansing was done. Recommendations? We need to do some studies and look critically to see how the viral survival in vaginal and subperiosal secretions and see the effects of water or other cleansing materials such as soap on HIV virus survival. And then the subperiosal immunological response with diluted and undiluted vaginal secretions. I'd like to acknowledge study participants, the staff, and the grant which supported this research. Thank you very much.
Very good.
If I could just make one comment from the chair. The N value of the delayed washing group was quite low. Was it 2? Did I see a value of 2?
Yes.
So that would make it way too low to draw any conclusion. I think you probably need to get quite a bigger study group or a longer period before you can really draw a conclusion about the delayed washing, which is, as you say, it's an odd finding anyway.
Right. Yeah, the only 2 incident cases in the delayed, those are 10 or more. And but when you collapse that group to less than within 3 minutes and 3 minutes and above, still there was a difference, statistical significant difference between those who washed within 3 minutes. And however, like again, I emphasized, these observation studies, I need to be very careful about any conclusions we make. That's why I gave a summary other than a conclusion.
Okay, thanks. Yes?
Andrew Burdick from Sydney, thanks for the presentation. I just had a question about confounding, because you presented your multivariate results to us, but not your univariate results.
Right.
And I'm just wondering, one explanation that you could think of is that men who wash are washing because they believe they're at greater risk of HIV. So was there any evidence that they were at greater risk of HIV? So were they more likely to report HIV-positive partners or more likely to report at-risk sexual behaviour?
Yeah, a lot of the confounding that I adjusted for was frequency of sex, condom use, and a colleague, again, advised, and we looked at the perceived HIV status of the sexual partner, and that did not change did not have any impact from the unadjusted and the adjusted analysis. However, perceived HIV infection was a risk factor for HIV acquisition.
So they didn't have any effect in the adjustment, but were they associated univariately with washing the genitals?
Yes, they associated, yes. They were.
Okay.
Pedro Ipachel from Lima, Peru. I have a question, so I didn't see anything with regards to ulcerative STIs. Were there STIs in the cohort of participants?
Yes, and again, I think the presentation, the publication made for in The Lancet shows the GUD. Yes, there was an impact on, there was the population had, the study group had STDs, and GUD was one factor that was outstanding in the circumcision study. Yes, the participants had GUD, but did not analyze or adjust for the STD in this presentation.
Okay, one last one. Thank you.
Thank you. Ben Cowie from Melbourne. Again, another question about confounding. With regards to the men who washed within 3 minutes versus those who washed later, was there any association with their perceived risk of the HIV positivity of their partner? Because it would be plausible that men who wash within 3 minutes are doing so because this is either a non-regular partner or a commercial sex worker or something, and I'm wondering whether that explains the increased risk of transmission in men who wash within 3 minutes is because that was a high-risk partner.
Yeah, it's interesting because, again, that concern, and I thank you really for keeping on bringing it up, because even during this analysis, it kept on coming up, and until we sat down and reanalyzed this data, and that did not contribute. However, if a male partner perceived that their female partners were infected, that increased the risk of HIV infection. However, adjusting for all that did not impact on the duration from post-coital completing sex to the cleansing thereafter. So we looked at that, and even the frequency of sex and also consent condom use issues came up, and looking at all those still did not seem to have any impact on the unadjusted associations.
Thank you very much, Fred.
Thank you.
Next presentation is from Peru. How willing are gay men to cut off the epidemic? This is going to be presented by Hang Guanira. He's a graduate in public health from the University of Washington, Seattle, working in Peru. She's been working in HIV field for the last 5 years. Please.
Uh, Thank you for the introduction. And the title of my presentation is How Willing Are the Gay Men to Cut Off the Epidemics, Circumcision Among MSM in the Andean Region. HIV epidemic in the Andean region, as well in US, Europe, and some other countries, is mainly concentrated in men who have sex with men. The number of cases continue to increase despite the broadly known preventive strategies already implemented. Male circumcision status have proven to be efficacious in reducing HIV acquisition in heterosexual men by 60%. But differences in vaginal versus anal mucosa and types of sexual roles might compromise the effectiveness of the intervention in MSM. Formative research is of need to assess the feasibility of the implementation of such studies in the MSM population. The objectives of this study were to assess the circumcision rates in MSM, to evaluate the willingness to participate in circumcision trials for HIV prevention among MSMs, and to identify concerns, barriers, and facilitators for the implementation of a circumcision trial in MSM population. This study was a cross-sectional study. The inclusion criteria were have had anal sex within the last 12 months, unknown HIV status or HIV negative, and not having HIV tested during the last 12 months, and have engaged in high-risk behavior. Procedures for all participants include clinical history, physical examination, behavioral assessment by computer-assisted self-interview, and also testing with rapid tests for HIV 1 and 2 and syphilis. This study was nested in the HIV sentinel surveillance among MSN in 5 Andean cities during the first quarter of 2006. A total of 2,618 MSN at high risk of HIV infection were enrolled in this study. It's to mention that all the 570 participants from one of the cities, Sullana, were excluded for this analysis due to issues in circumcision status assessment. The accrual for the remaining cities were Lima, 676 participants, Arequipa, 417 participants, Ica, 414 participants, and Guayaquil, Ecuador, 541 participants. In the map, you can see the geographical location of these cities. Guayaquil, Lima, and Ica were located in the coast, and Arequipa was located in the highlands of Peru. The total sample for this analysis was 2,048 participants. 41 of them refused to be examined, so circumcision status could not be assessed. 75 were completely circumcised, and 1,932 were not circumcised by physical examination. A willingness to participate in a circumcision trial questionnaire was applied for those not circumcised. This table shows the selected demographic and behavioral characteristics for all participants. The mean age of the participant was 26 years old across all the cities. And most of the participants have at least high school education also. The sexual role in the 5 years was assessed using a 5-point Likert scale that ranged from exclusive insertive to exclusive receptive. For further analysis, because the effective of circumcision will only protect those insertive, the three first categories will be considered as insertive and the other two as receptive. This graphic shows the rates of syphilis, HIV, and also the estimated incidence of HIV PED ELISA across the cities. Lima and Guayaquil have the higher rates of HIV and syphilis compared to Arequipa and Ica, being Guayaquil the greatest affected, with an HIV rates of more than 18%. Circumcision rates are consistently low across cities, with a mean of 3.7%, being higher in Lima and Guayaquil compared to Arequipa and Ica. The univariate analysis of the willingness to participate in a circumcision trial among those not circumcised show an association to the city where the participants live. People living in Arequipa and Ica, cities with less than 1 million inhabitants, were less likely to be willing compared to Lima, the most populated city. And people living in Guayaquil, second most populated city in this study, were more likely to be willing. In the multivariate analysis, also, having higher education was independently associated with the willingness to participate. Also is to mention that those insertive were more willing than those not receptive, but the difference was not significant. Concerns about participation in a circumcision trial were assessed, and the major concerns were to have surgical procedure, side effects of the surgery like pain, swelling, or secretions, and that their partner would insist in having sex without condoms. No major concerns related to the follow-up of the follow-up period or the HIV testing were reported. So, MSN at high risk in the Andean region have high rates of HIV and STIs. Circumcision rates in MSN are low across all the cities. No association between circumcision and HIV infection were seen when all the sample was analyzed, but a trend to a significant protective effect was seen when only those insertive were analyzed. Higher education and living in large cities are independently associated to be willing to participate in a circumcision trial for HIV prevention in MSM. And major concerns of undergoing circumcision are related to surgical procedure and misperception of protection. Because the design, convenience-based samples, self-selection bias, and recall bias are main limitations. But also, moreover, low rates of circumcision in the sample decrease the power to find association between circumcision and HIV infection. And finally, the results cannot be generalized to other populations. Then we may conclude that because the low rate of circumcision, the high incidence of HIV, and the high rates of willingness, a circumcision study to assess the efficacy in the prevention of HIV is feasible in the MSM population of Lima and Guayaquil. I would like to acknowledge all my colleagues that participate in this study, especially to those participants in those all the cities. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Han. All right. Thanks very much. Any questions?
Yes.
Yes, please.
Hans Jäger from Munich, you showed us nicely that you had to exclude 570 people from analysis because of issues in assessing circumcision. Could you share with us what these issues were?
That was an entire city that was not included in the study because the physician didn't assess correctly the circumcision status in that city. So we realized that the circumcision status was not well assessed, and when we asked the staff of that city, we realized that they were not assessing the circumcision as it was supposed to be done.
But could you share with us what these difficulties were? Because we all have to learn from this, I guess.
Well, for example, they confused the phimosis status with circumcision. So they consider people with phimosis as circumcised. So was a problem with the training in that city.
Hi, I am Deepa Naveen from PSI India.
Yes.
And I would like to congratulate you on doing a wonderful study. I think this is one of the first studies that I'm seeing here, which is trying to do a segmentation between somewhat what we call as the behaviors and the non-behaviors. And I think this definitely is a difficulty if you do not have sufficient numbers for your segmentation, that you cannot have the kind of a correlation that you are trying to work with. So I'm just trying to understand, was this a kind of a pilot study? Are you trying to follow it up with another study where you can ensure having enough numbers for both the groups?
Yes. In fact, we conduct a second part in Lima to enroll 900 more participants. This data is now being evaluated by the relationship between circumcision and HIV infection still was not significant, but was really close to the significance. Was the odds ratio were about 0.33, and the p-value was 0.07.
And there's just one another comment here. The population characteristics, what you are using, like the age or the other characteristics that you have just shown, except for the sexual behavior, I think those are the population characteristics that a program cannot work on. A program can work on it in terms of only a targeting approach. But those cannot be like the determinants of the behavior, which like if we want to change the circumcision and promote the motivate the men for circumcision, that cannot be a determinant. So your other factors for your circumcision, whether a man would go for it or not, those should be further explored in the study.
Yes, thank you for the question and the comments. We do the analysis for the circumcision association for HIV, and also having in account the type, the kind of sex, the participant have with the last partner. Because it depends on not only if the participant says that they was insertive, this person, but also the kind of sex they have with their partners. They can say they are main insertive, but in the last partner have receptive sex with condom, without condom, insertive sex with condom, without condom. We try to control for all those characteristics to do this analysis.
Thank you very much. I'll hand over the chair to Brian to continue with chairing this.
Thank you. The next talk will be by David Templeton and on behalf of his colleagues at the National Centre in HIV Epidemiology and Clinical Research and the National Centre in HIV Social Research at the University of New South Wales here in Sydney. And the title of the talk is Circumcision Status and Risk of HIV Seroconversion in the HIM Cohort of Homosexual Men in Sydney.
Okay. Thank you, Brian. I was discussing the results of this talk to some of the participants of our study and some of the gay representatives of the gay community organisations in Sydney last week, and unawares of what I was actually saying, referred to providing them with a snippet of the information I was providing today. Then even worse, as you can imagine, to an audience of predominantly gay men, change that to a taste of the information I was providing today. So I'm simply going to say today I will present our research on circumcision status and risk of HIV seroconversion in the Health and Men cohort. And thank you to the organisers for allowing the opportunity to present on behalf of my colleagues. First, I'll briefly present some background on this topic and then outline the methods of the Health in Men study. I'll then present some related analysis that we have performed in the Health in Men study, including demographic predictors of circumcision status and a sub-study that we carried out validating self-reported circumcision status by clinical examination. Finally, I'll present the main parts of our analysis on circumcision and risk of HIV seroconversion in our cohort. We heard an excellent presentation yesterday morning from Professor Bailey, which outlined the benefits of circumcision in African men, and we've heard that several times this morning, that among heterosexual African men, there's now pretty conclusive evidence that it reduces HIV incidence by around 60%. However, in contrast, there's relatively few and conflicting studies among homosexual men. The first study was carried out in the early 90s in a clinic-based population and reported more than twice the risk of HIV positivity among uncircumcised men. However, a more recent clinic-based study that was presented last year at Florida reported no association of circumcision status with prevalent HIV infection among STD clinic attendees in San Francisco. Also, a smaller study among homosexual men who had recently seroconverted to HIV and who reported insert of unprotected anal sex as their probable highest risk exposure leading to the infection, there was no association of circumcision status in that study either. The only other prospective cohort study which has looked at this issue was published a couple of years ago in JADES and found an adjusted odds ratio of 2 with increased HIV risk in uncircumcised men after controlling for sexual behaviour, drug use and demographic factors. The Health in Men study recruited Sydney gay community attached men between 2001 and 2004. At recruitment, participants underwent an HIV test and HIV negative men were enrolled into the study. Detailed sexual and other behavioural data was collected every 6 months at alternating face-to-face and telephone interviews. All participants were offered testing for sexually transmitted infections at each face-to-face interview, and approximately 90% agreed to this testing each year. In addition, participants self-reported sexually transmitted infections diagnosed outside the study in the previous 12 months at that face-to-face interview. Circumcision status was self-reported at baseline and validated by clinical examination in a subgroup of participants. All participants underwent annual HIV testing, and an annual match with the National HIV Register was performed to identify participants who were lost to follow-up from the study and whose HIV infections were diagnosed elsewhere in Australia. For our statistical analysis, we used Cox regression. A diverse recruitment strategy was used for the Health in Men study. As you can see, most participants were recruited at gay community events, with only a small number recruited at the clinics. Therefore, we consider our study population to be broadly representative of Sydney gay community-attached men. Over 1,400 men were enrolled, with an 80% retention rate at 2 years. The median age of participants was 35 years, and median follow-up time was 3 years. Participants lost to follow-up did not differ significantly in terms of their circumcision status compared with the entire cohort at baseline. 95% of participants self-identified as gay or homosexual. Critics of some past research on this topic have cited inadequate control for demographic factors which could confound any association of circumcision status and HIV seroconversion. So we previously sought to elucidate some of these factors. We found that 2/3 of participants reported being circumcised at baseline, with the vast majority circumcised as an infant. On multivariate analysis, older age was strongly associated with being circumcised, as were ethnicity and country of birth. When we excluded the 17 Jewish and Muslim participants, all of whom were circumcised, there was no association between religious affiliation and circumcision status. Also, there was no association between circumcision status and level of education or income. Correlation with clinical examination findings and self-reported circumcision status has been reported previously by some authors to be poor, and we were unable to find any published research on validation of self-reported circumcision status among homosexual men. So we sought to validate participant self-reported circumcision status. From February to June this year, 87% of HIM participants approached at their annual face-to-face interview, agreed to be examined by the study nurse, and the study nurse was unaware of the reported circumcision status at the baseline interview. I suppose, unsurprisingly, all gay men managed to say if they were circumcised or not correctly. So there was 100% concordance between baseline self-report and clinical examination findings in that subgroup. Overall, to the end of 2006, there were 49 HIV seroconversions in the Health and Men study, an incidence of 0.8 per 100 person years. For our analysis of circumcision status and HIV risk, we excluded six participants whose HIV infections were only identified by matching with the national database, and for whom the behavioural data we had was over 12 months old. In addition, we also excluded another participant who notably also seroconverted and was the only one who reported a surgically reconstructed foreskin at baseline. Therefore, the analysis of circumcision status and HIV risk was based on 42 seroconversions. Univariate analysis revealed no association between circumcision status and HIV seroconversion. And actually, when we included the six seroconverters identified by matching with the national register, that had little effect on the hazard ratio presented here. Because of its strong association with being circumcised, we forced age into the multivariate model, despite a lack of univariate association with HIV incidence. Of the other demographic factors associated with circumcision in HIM, neither ethnicity nor country of birth were associated with HIV seroconversion and weren't included in the multivariate model. We also controlled for unprotected receptive anal intercourse according to the reported serostatus of participants' sexual partners, as this was the single sexual behavioural variable most strongly associated with HIV seroconversion on univariate analysis. Finally, we controlled for self-reported anal warts and study-confirmed anal gonorrhea, as these were the only STIs significantly associated with HIV seroconversion. After controlling for age, unprotected anal sex by partner serostatus, and these anal STIs, there remained no association between HIV incidence and being circumcised, with an adjusted hazard ratio of 0.88 in circumcised men. As most gay men are infected with HIV via receptive unprotected anal intercourse, and thus there is no potential for their own circumcision status to protect them against HIV, we performed a stratified analysis on participants who were more likely to have contracted HIV by insertive anal sex. Now, obviously, a word of caution here, this analysis is based on very, very small numbers, and so the confidence intervals are very wide. However, when we did this analysis of the nine who reported no unprotected receptive anal sex, there remained no association even when we controlled for age. So in conclusion, we found no association of circumcision status with incident HIV infection in this cohort of community-attached Sydney gay men. This lack of association is not really surprising, given that multivariate analysis of anal sexual behaviours as risk factors for HIV in HIM found an association with receptive and not insertive anal sexual practices. The strengths of our study design include validation of circumcision status and the analysis of and control for potential confounding factors. However, the low HIV incidence, especially in those reporting no unprotected receptive anal sex, limits any firm conclusions that can be drawn. I just noticed in the previous speech by Dr. Gorinha, sorry, I'm not pronouncing it properly, though that he reported 30 to 60% of the population in the Andean region reported exclusively insertive anal sex. So perhaps investigating further this issue in populations where there is greater division into exclusively receptive and insertive practices may provide more information on this topic. However, despite the convincing evidence of circumcision on HIV incidence in African heterosexual men, we feel the few and conflicting data that exist in homosexual men suggest that it would be premature to consider promoting circumcision as an HIV prevention intervention in this group. So I'd just like to finally thank my collaborators and colleagues at both national centres in Sydney. I'd especially like to thank Professor Andrew Grulich and Dr. Jeff Jin, my boss at Sydney Southwest, Dr. Cathy O'Connor, for allowing me extended leave to undertake this research, our funders, of course, the participants and the excellent Penn study team. And I'd just like to refer you to Jeff Jin's poster, which has got more detailed analysis of anal sexual behaviours as risk factors for HIV seroconversion. Thank you for your attention.
Yeah, thank you very much. Are there any questions? Perhaps as people are coming to the microphone, I just might ask one of my own. You mentioned the possible lack of power in this study. I think you had about 1,000 subjects. Of course, the study by Bookbinder that you referred to, in fact, had 3,257 homosexual men in six different US cities. So it's a much more powerful study, and that, as you said, showed a doubling of the risk in the uncircumcised men. Of course, the other case is the of heterosexual men, and there have been a number of studies there as well where the rates are between a three- and fourfold higher if the men are uncircumcised, and that's again in the USA. And you point out that there's these discrepancies. So why? I mean, why are these major differences between the American results and these results here in Sydney and some of the other studies that are actually in America as well?
Yeah, it's certainly something that we've considered. I mean, obviously, I think in America, certainly the circumcision rates are much higher. I believe in the Bookbinder study, the circumcision rates approached 90% compared with ours, which were about 66% at baseline. And certainly the ethnic mix in the US is quite different. You have much higher proportions of ethnic minorities. The African Americans, the Hispanics, proportionally account for a much larger number of the population, and they have in their populations much different circumcision rates to those in the Caucasian population. So I guess there are quite a lot of potential differences and potential confounding factors, and certainly we wouldn't feel that our results from Australia could be extrapolated to other developed countries, certainly the US, because of some of those differences.
Yes. My name is Joshua Formentera from the Philippines. I'd like to tell you that we would be very glad if Filipinos in 90% are circumcised, so we don't have to go through this kind of pain. My question is reflect to all the presenters today. My question here is regards with your work. If this is reflected in the national guidelines, do you have any clue or you have any developed guidelines in each of the country that would bring you with your work? Because without the absence of guidelines in each country, that posed challenge in each of us in our interventions.
Are you asking about guidelines of circumcision?
Each of the country. I'm asking the question to all the presenters today. Is this your work has reflected with the national guidelines, or is there any guidelines being created?
Certainly, I think, and certainly in Australia, based on there's certainly many pro and anti-circumcision groups, as there are in many other parts of the world, and I guess that certainly those groups would quote many published studies which have shown benefits and risks associated with the practice. But from an HIV prevention point of view, aside from mentioning the African studies, which of course are impossible to generalise to an Australian population, there's certainly no guidelines on the basis of circumcision preventing HIV in the Australian population.
Perhaps I can just add something. Things are in progress with the Royal Australian College of Physicians. Their previous study has been heavily criticised. In a publication, the Australian New Zealand Journal of Public Health, by myself and colleagues early last year. And as a response to that, they realised that an evidence-based review using public health people, not just paediatricians, was required. And that's underway. And that is supposed to be reported at the end of this year. And I think the evidence not just HIV/AIDS, but many other conditions which you can find in the brochures that I've left around the room and outside, which you're welcome to take as many as you wish, clearly indicate a plethora of benefits across a whole range of different conditions and diseases, both in men and in their sexual partners, male and female.
I may add that for the presenter, the first two presentations were from Uganda, and as you know, some of the trials that associated the reduction of HIV acquisition with circumcision were done in Uganda. Uganda government is actually in the process of formulating guidelines for scaling up circumcision, and this guideline will be out fairly very soon. So yes, there is an effort to have guidelines, country guidelines, specific guidelines, or modifications of the guidelines as generated by WHO and UNAIDS in March. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. The next talk is by Greg Londish at the School of Mathematics, the University of New South Wales here in Sydney. The title of the talk is Mathematical Modelling of Male Circumcision in Sub-Saharan Africa Predicts Significant Reduction in Adult HIV Prevalence, Even When It Is Limited to Certain Age Groups.
Thank you very much to the organisers for allowing us to present our research. Well, with the recent growth in the evidence for male circumcision reducing the risk of HIV infection in heterosexual African men, we investigated the impact of a circumcision-based intervention in sub-Saharan Africa. Specifically, we had three objectives. The first was to determine by how much HIV prevalence could be reduced if only part of the population was circumcised. The second was to determine which groups should be targeted if total coverage is impossible. And third, how sensitive an intervention would be to increases in risky behaviour. Our model was to create a mathematical model to simulate the course of an HIV epidemic in a sub-Saharan African population under different intervention scenarios. In our model, we divide the population up into groups based on gender, age, sexual activity, circumcised and uncircumcised, and HIV infection. Given the setting of Africa, we limited transmission modes to heterosexual contact and mother-to-child infection. With sexual contacts, we assumed that mixing was dependent on age alone, with men mixing preferentially with younger women and female sex workers. Our model starts the epidemic in 1980 with initial conditions taken from historical data and simulates the epidemic until 2020. Given that time span, we also simulated the demographics of the population, including fertility and death rates. This slide shows a simplified diagram of the model, and you can see that at first the population is split up into uninfected and infected, male and female. The population is then split up further into a core group and a non-core group. The core group is a high-risk minority, comprising between 0 and 20% of the population, and each member has about 3 to 5 times the number of sexual contacts per year compared to a non-core member of the same gender. The reason for this is that a core group is often responsible for maintaining an epidemic in a population where it would otherwise die out. We then split up men into circumcised and uncircumcised, and though it's not illustrated on the diagram, each group is split up into 80 age groups, spanning 1 year each, and the infected class is split up into 5 different stages of HIV infection. The red arrows indicate the major transmission mode of heterosexual contact from men to women and vice versa. For each intervention scenario considered, we generated a paired set of simulations, a control set, and a set with an intervention starting in 2007. Each pairing in the set, in the simulations, had the same parameter values, and this allowed us to calculate the reduction in HIV prevalence due to the intervention alone. To account for the uncertainty in our parameters, for example, the relative risk of a circumcised man is approximately 60%, but can range between 30 and 70%. So to account for this, we used a Monte Carlo method to generate the mean reduction in adult HIV prevalence as well as the 95% confidence intervals. In this, we repeated our simulations 500 times for each scenario and used Latin Hyperkube sampling to select the parameter values. The parameters and their values were taken from published data of observational studies, clinical trials, and other models. To confirm the validity of our model, we compared data of male circumcision and HIV prevalence in different African countries in 2003 for the same data produced by our model. This graph shows the two data sets, the circles representing the observational studies, and the lines and squares representing our model. And you can see that on the whole, the model and the observations agree. There are some countries that lie outside the 95% confidence intervals of the model, but more recent estimates of HIV prevalence in these countries have been lower, lying well within the bounds of the model. The data also suggests that there are specific additional specific region factors that we have not modelled. The first set of results that I'd like to discuss is the reduction in HIV prevalence when only part of the population is circumcised. In this scenario, we started with different levels of male circumcision and from 2007 began circumcising additional percentage of the population. This graph shows the decrease in HIV prevalence depending on the additional percentage circumcised, and you can see that the reduction is roughly proportional to the additional percentage circumcised. To put this in the context of an actual African country, take Zimbabwe for example. In 2003, Zimbabwe had an adult HIV prevalence of approximately 25% and only 10% of men were circumcised. If, starting this year, Zimbabwe were to circumcise the remaining 90% of its male population, our model conservatively predicts that HIV prevalence could drop to 13% by 2020. If only 50% of the population is circumcised under this intervention, HIV prevalence could drop to 18%. We also considered targeting men if total coverage wasn't possible. And we first considered targeting men depending on their age. This table shows the reduction in adult HIV prevalence depending on which age group is circumcised. And you can see that the greatest reduction occurs when men between the ages of 20 and 25 or 25 and 30 years old are circumcised. This suggests that the optimal age group for reducing HIV prevalence in 2020 is centered around the age of 25. We also considered circumcising men depending on their sexual activity. As I said before, the core group is a high-risk minority of the population, and this table shows the reduction in adult HIV prevalence depending on if the core group is targeted or excluded. You can see that if the core group alone is circumcised, the reduction in prevalence is 37% of what could have been achieved if all men were circumcised, even though the core group only makes up 10% of the population on average. Conversely, omitting the core group leads to a reduction in HIV prevalence of only 73% of what could have been achieved had they been included. These results suggest that when total coverage is not possible, priority should be given to men between the ages of 20 and 30 years old, and if identifiable, men who have an above-average number of sexual contacts per year. The last set of results I'd like to discuss is the sensitivity of an intervention to an increase in the number of sexual partnerships. It is difficult to predict just how a desired increase in sexual activity will translate into the actual number and distribution of sexual partnerships in a population. And to resolve this, we created two extreme scenarios. The first scenario involves circumcising all uncircumcised men starting in 2007, and a percentage of these men from the low-risk group would enter the high-risk core group. This doesn't increase the total number of partnerships in a population, as women do not change their behaviour in response under these assumptions. Instead, it increases the competition for high-risk relationships and contact with female sex workers. This graph shows a reduction in adult HIV prevalence, depending on the percentage of men who enter the core group. And you can see that, on average, the intervention's effectiveness is reduced, but it still provides some reduction in adult HIV prevalence. Okay. The second scenario was similar to the first, in the sense that the same percentage of men moved from the non-core group to the core group after they were circumcised. But this time, the same percentage of women entered the high-risk core group as well. So in this case, the total number of partnerships did increase. You can see that on average, the intervention is negated when approximately 40% of these men and women increase their number of sexual contacts per year. Now, these two scenarios provide two extremes of what could happen under an intervention. And so our model would suggest that it takes significantly more than 40% of these men and women to increase their sexual contacts per year before the intervention is undone. Still, we would suggest that some kind of counselling is required to maintain the effectiveness of intervention. So in conclusion, Our mathematical models show that circumcision can lead to significant reductions in adult HIV prevalence without requiring every man to be circumcised. It also shows that this reduction in HIV prevalence is proportional to the additional percentage of the population that is circumcised. The model also demonstrates that where total coverage is not possible, priority should be given to 20 to 30-year-old men and, if identifiable, men who have a high number of sexual contacts per year. Lastly, the model shows that an intervention is relatively robust to increases in risk behavior, but some kind of education about the exact benefits is needed to maximize its impact. Thank you very much.
Questions? Yes.
I'm Barry Hill from the International Community of Women Living with HIV and AIDS, and this is directed to all the presenters. And I wanted to know, was there any discussion or concern or reporting by any of the subjects before or after they were circumcised as to whether or not there would be a change in sexual pleasure or sensation because of circumcision?
Well, ours was a mathematical model, so no people were involved. So I'm going to pass it over to other people.
If I can comment on that issue of sensitivity, sexual pleasure, sensation, all of the good research that's been conducted shows no difference. I think case closed, especially the most recent studies published this year on sensation during arousal using thermal imaging.
We didn't get any complaints.
Well, in Rakai, we have looked at sexual satisfaction in both men and women, and we are seeing very high levels of satisfaction after surgery, levels as high as 99%.
Gary Rogers, in the Pacific Islands. I've got a question for Greg. You chose HIV prevalence as your outcome in the model, so you therefore must have made some assumptions about death rates. And I'd be interested to know how treatment and falling death rates would affect your outcomes, but also ask why you didn't choose incidence rather than prevalence.
Well, to answer that in the opposite order, we did use incidence, just brevity of time and space means I couldn't present it today. Hopefully we'll have a paper out soon that does include incidence. As for treatment, we didn't specifically model treatment of HIV-infected people. We just wanted to concentrate on the impact of circumcision alone. Obviously, that's something to look at between the synergies between circumcision and other interventions and treatments.
Okay. Thank you very much. The next talk will be given by Bertrand Overt on behalf of his colleagues. Bertrand Overt is from the INSERM Unit 687 in France. And the title of the talk is Cost of the Rollout of Male Circumcision in Sub-Saharan Africa. Thank you.
Good morning. We've done this... can I have the slide? We've done this study with a multidisciplinary team of 10 researchers indicated on this slide. So the objectives of this study was to calculate key health economics estimates of the rollout of medical adult male circumcision in sub-Saharan Africa. So this study is limited to medical adult male circumcision. We are not going to consider traditional circumcision or infant circumcision. And the idea was to calculate 5 estimates: the number of circumcisers needed, the cost of the rollout, the net cost when we take into account adjustment for averted HIV medical cost, the cost per HIV infection averted, which is the cost effectiveness, and the number of circumcision to avoid one HIV infection. This study was limited to a given number of countries. In order to select these countries, we apply the rule of countries having a high, relatively high HIV prevalence. In this case, it was more than 5% and countries with a low HIV, male circumcision prevalence, in this case it was 80%. So using these two criteria, we have selected 14 countries, and to this list we have added the Nyanza province of Kenya and Uganda. So as a result, we have a list of 16 countries covering the southern part of Africa and some eastern part of Africa and some two other countries, for a total of 96 million of people among these 16 countries, with a total of 30.5 million of uncircumcised males. And South Africa in this list represents 26% of these 30.5 million, showing the important role that South Africa can play in this rollout. The method was using a mathematical model developed for this study. This model has three sub-models: a demographics model, a cost model, and an HIV model. It's a very classical susceptible infected model with people in groups indicated on that slide, with circumcised men, uncircumcised men, women, children, adults, HIV positive, HIV negative, and a set of differential equations controlling the movement of people from one group to another. For each, so the model was run for each of these 16 countries independently, and then the results were put together in order to have the full result. So for each sitting, we have a list of 32 input parameters. So have you, of course, it's a very crude representation of reality, and using this model, we have calculated the numerical value for the 4-5 estimates, plus using a Monte Carlo simulation, some idea of the confidence interval of each estimate. So let me just describe very quickly some input. We have the effect of male circumcision. We have the percentage of male who will not accept the intervention. We have the duration. Here it's 5 years duration of time. When we apply the intervention, that means that in this case we will take 5 years to circumcise most of the male accepting the intervention. We have two delivery models. We have a private model and a public model. And in the private model, we have the cost per circumcision, which includes also the cost of counseling, VCT, and treatment of adverse events. In the public delivery model, it's a bit more. We have more parameters. For example, we have the salary of each circumciser. Now we have in the HIV model, we have, for example, the cost of ART. What are the results? The first estimate the number of circumcisers needed. We find that we need about 2,300 circumcisers to roll out male circumcision in these 16 countries during the first 5 years. And then after the first 5 years, we just have to circumcise those becoming adults, so it's a much lower number. And in this case, we found that after the first 5 years, for the years 6, 7, and so on, we need only 600 circumcisers, which is about 0.07 circumciser per 10,000 adults. The cost of the rollout, if we calculate the cost for the first 10 years, it's very similar in the private and the public model. And it's between 0.9 billion of US dollars for the first 10 years to 1.6 billion of US dollars. If you calculate it per adult per year, then on average it's between 0.9 and 1.7 US dollars per adult per year. But the value is much higher during the first 5 years, about 2. And then after the year 5, year 6, 7, and so on, it's only 0.5 US dollars per adult per year. The net cost, when we take into account the averted HIV medical cost, Then during the first 10 years, it cost something. It cost about $600 million. And then if we calculate it over a 20-year period of time, then it's saving money, and we are saving about $3 to $4 billion. The cost per HIV infection averted varies from about 100 to 300 to 400 per HIV infection averted adult in the first 10 to 20 years. And the number of circumcision to avoid one HIV infection varies from 4 to 9 in this simulation exercise. In conclusion, I want to say that it's a crude analysis because, as you can see, the model is a crude representation of reality. We have only 32 parameters. We didn't take into account traditional circumcision. We didn't take into account circumcision of newborns or babies. But as a result, it's expensive. But I think it's reasonable. It's not too expensive. And it cannot help us to choose what kind of implementation model we have to use, either public or private. The results were very similar using the two delivery models. I think the choice will be done using other information like local context and so on. And clearly, cost is maybe not the main issue. Maybe more other issue like availability of providers are probably more important than the cost. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions? Just come to the microphone. No questions? How about questions from the speakers in the front here? Any questions? Sounds like you've convinced us all, or everyone's keen to get to lunch. So with that, I'll just ask everyone to join with me in thanking once again all of the speakers.